All right, Paul's letter to Titus. We are still in chapter 1. So let's go ahead and turn there if you would. And I'll kind of whet your appetite for today. I actually have perhaps a couple stories to tell, if time allows. Haven't done that for a long, long time. And two short video clips to watch. Doesn't that just put you on the edge of your seat? Special treat. Hopefully. All right, well, what we have here in this passage is Paul instructing Titus, of course, to appoint elders in the various churches on the island of Crete, and he spells out a number of qualifications that a man being considered must meet. This list is very similar to the one we find in 1 Timothy. Both letters were written at about the same time and address similar situations. One might conclude that Paul uses the plural form elders only because there are several churches in Crete, and that he is merely telling Titus to appoint one elder over each church. If so, then that person would probably function something similar to that of a pastor. But this is not the practice we see in 1 Timothy or elsewhere in Acts or even other places in the New Testament. Rather, each church had several elders, a plurality, and we would assume that this is what Paul intended here in for the churches in Crete as well. All right, that said, let's follow along as I read verses 5 through 9, and I'll be reading out of the 1984 version of the NIV, in case you see some differences in whatever you may be using. The reason I left you in Crete was that you might straighten out what was left unfinished and appoint elders in every town as I directed you. An elder must be blameless, the husband of but one wife, a man whose children believe and are not open to the charge of being wild and disobedient. Since an overseer is entrusted with God's work, he must be blameless, not overbearing, not quick-tempered, not given to drunkenness, not violent, not pursuing dishonest gain. Rather, he must be hospitable, one who loves what is good, who is self-controlled, upright, holy, and disciplined. He must hold firmly to the trustworthy message as it has been taught, so that he can encourage others by sound doctrine and refute those who oppose it. All right, last time, which would have been 2 weeks ago, we covered verse 5 and the first half of verse 6. Basically, we just kind of got a start on this section. Today, the plan is to finish up on those traits that deal with one's character, taking us down to the end of verse 8. And we'll save verse 9, which is actually a qualification dealing with doctrinal orthodoxy, for the next time. Now, it's a rather slow going here for us at the beginning of the list, for the exact meanings of the first two qualifications that Paul lays out are not entirely clear. There is some debate on what he intended, and once we get past those, everything else will be pretty easy going. Last time we addressed the first of those, husband of but one wife, and as we noted, there are good arguments made for the case that those words should be understood and translated as faithful to his wife. And indeed, some Bible translations actually render it that way. Today, we'll be looking at the second one, a man whose children believe. This, too, has been the subject of much discussion, this requirement that all the children of an elder be Christians. Here as well, we find a number of scholars argue that this is not the best translation of the original Greek words and that something else is meant instead. So we'll spend some time on that this morning. Some of this will seem a bit technical, quite frankly, even tedious and most likely to many even irrelevant. A few of you may be thinking, well, I'm not an elder, never going to become an elder, and you might be tempted to kind of zone out. But the points raised today go well beyond just those who serve in that capacity to everyone, seriously, the whole church body, and for several reasons. One big one is that members of the church, here at least, are called upon to affirm new elders, to evaluate them in light of these qualifications, and likewise, each year, members are asked to affirm those who are currently serving based on the same standard. And so it's obviously important that we all have a correct understanding of these requirements and appreciate the significance of each one. Everyone wants a healthy church, but a healthy church requires a healthy leadership, and so those who have a say and who serves in that leadership are obligated to know, understand, and apply the standards provided us in Scripture. And also, and this is very important, as we consider everything listed here in verses 6, 7, and 8, we should note that these are virtues expected of all believers, not just church elders. And this is apparent as you read through the rest of the New Testament. All right, but before we get too far into this, it might be good to review something I pointed out in the previous week. The first thing Paul says about a candidate under consideration is that he must be blameless, or in some translations, above reproach. The fact that this particular trait heads the list and is repeated again later in verse 7 strongly suggests that blamelessness is the primary qualification of which all the others help to explain. And so instead of blameless with a comma after it, it might be best to see it as blameless with a semicolon, or rather a colon. The concern, of course, here is that there would be no grounds upon which someone could base an accusation or charge against him, and then lists out a variety of areas, or various areas. On the flip side of that, we should be careful to note that it doesn't mean that he has to be perfect, completely sinless. If that were the case, then no one could serve. There would be no church elders anywhere, ever. There will be times he will fail. As fallen humans, that's going to happen, unfortunately. And given his fallen nature, there will no doubt be one or two items on this list that will prove to be especially challenging. And so we need to think of these qualifications here as dealing with a man's overall character, actually his reputation. It is not that he is completely flawless, but that these particular virtues listed here in verses 6 through 9 are ones that he is known to possess. They are observable among believers and non-believers alike. The main thrust here again is this: his conversion, his break from the worldly passions of the present evil age and all its deceitful corruption and ungodliness must be genuine, and it must be noticeable, and it needs to be consistently noticeable. All right, following the charge to be blameless, Paul begins to list itself with two traits to deal with the quality of the man's home life, his relationship with his wife, and his relationship with his children. Both are to be carefully evaluated when assessing his eligibility for church eldership. Having addressed the relationship with his wife last week, we're now ready to consider the one about his children. So let's pick it up where we left off the last time, the second part of verse 6. An elder must be a man whose children believe and are not open to the charge of being wild and disobedient. Obviously, if you can't manage things at home, you shouldn't have any part in managing the church. The first question that comes up is this: are the children here referring to those still living at home, or also to adult offspring who have moved out, perhaps living on their own, maybe even married with their own children? Well, in my research on this, I was surprised that this wasn't a subject of debate. It's a question I've heard kicked around all my life, but the consensus among Bible commentators and scholars is that children mentioned here refer to kids at home, still living under the authority of their parents. There are several different Greek words that are translated children in our English Bibles, and while they all have some similarity in their meanings, each are used to emphasize a particular aspect. The word used here primarily highlights a child's relationship with his parents, or you might think standing. The issue isn't his age or his birth order or his sex. Rather, it is that he relates to his parents as one under their care and responsibility, and therefore under their authority. And it's the same word used in Ephesians and Colossians, where children are told to obey their parents. And the word is often applied outside blood relationships as well, commonly, as in a student's relationship to his teacher, or a disciple's relationship to his master or mentor. Paul, as you will remember, refers to both Timothy and Titus as his sons in the faith. It's the same word that he uses in this passage of children. The meaning may not be strictly limited to this, but that would certainly be the primary idea behind it, and seems to be the meaning here in this verse as well. When you consider its context, the home life of a man, it's pretty obvious that the children being referred to here are those who are still living at home, still under the care of their father, and still abiding by the rules of that home, regardless of their age, whether they're 5 or 35. But good luck with those who are 35 still living at home. As we know, they don't always like rules. Now, at the same time, when it comes to evaluating men for eldership, we would probably not want to limit ourselves to just the kids at home. If there are adult children who have moved out and are on their own, I think it is a fair question to ask, what does the relationship with their father look like? Is there respect and love, or is it contentious or estranged? If so, why? I think that's a fair question. The next question about this verse, a bigger question, is how we are to understand the word that has been translated believe. There is no dispute about the not being wild and disobedient part that follows, but there is dispute over the must believe part. This lack of consensus can be demonstrated by the various ways the verse is translated. In the NIV, a man whose children believe. In the ESV, his children are believers. In the New American Standard, having children who believe. And in the Phillips, kind of a paraphrase, a responsible paraphrase, with children brought up as Christians. Okay, as you can see, they're all very similar. And then we have four translations that put a different spin on this. The King James, the New King James, the Holman Christian Standard Bible, and the New English Translation, who render it as faithful. Men who have faithful children that cannot be accused or charged with living with wild living and disobedience. Well, the Greek word here in question is pista, the plural of pistos. If we were to go with the active sense of that word, the meaning would be that of trusting or believing, thus one who believes in Christ, the way the first group of our translations here render it. If one were instead to go with the passive understanding, the meaning would be more like trustworthy or faithful and would emphasize the child's behavior, not so much his belief system. And we see this understanding brought out in the second group of translations. There are plenty of examples of this word being used in both ways throughout the New Testament. Most of them by far are used in the passive sense. In Paul's writings, we find it used in the passive sense 3/4 of the time. Pretty significant. Paul uses this word in Titus 3 times, the verse we are currently looking at, and then in verse 9 in describing the gospel message as trustworthy, and again in chapter 2 to describe a saying that is trustworthy. The word is often used of God to refer to his steadfastness, his consistent reliability. You know, he is dependable. And interestingly, this word has also been used in the Bible to describe the chronic illness, or to describe a chronic illness, meaning that it can be counted on to last, you know, that holds on to the dear end. So to boil this down, we would have 2 possible meanings. Children must be believers and not be wild and disobedient. Children must be trustworthy, that is, not wild and disobedient. Given that the word pistos far more often means trustworthy than believing, it would not be unreasonable to favor the second interpretation. However, the meaning of a word is not determined by how often it is used one way or the other and counting that all up, but by the actual context itself. And the question now is, what meaning is most likely intended here in Titus 1:6? First, we should take into consideration the parallel passage in 1 Timothy 3, where Paul provides a list of qualifications for elders at Ephesus. Again, both lists are very, very similar. There in 1 Timothy, he makes no mention of children having to be believers. He simply states that the man under consideration for eldership must manage his children well and that they must obey him with proper respect. It would seem a bit odd that Paul would make believing children a requirement at Crete and not a requirement at Ephesus. Secondly, when you think about it, it seems a bit unreasonable to make a father ultimately responsible for a child's acceptance of the gospel. Certainly a father can teach his children and set an example and insist on a lifestyle that is in keeping with Christian virtues and so on, but that's altogether different than making or forcing a son or daughter to become a follower of Christ. Good and wise parents can influence their children's actions, encourage them to be trustworthy, but they cannot control their spiritual response to God, not ultimately. Even under the best of circumstances, the best Christian environment possible, in a perfectly ideal setting, no one can guarantee that anyone, including children, will embrace the gospel for his or her own. And the third factor that needs to be taken into account is the situation at Crete itself. The churches on that island are quite young. The believers are fairly new to the faith, and we'd have to wonder if there has really been enough time for fathers to bring up Christian children. In fact, Paul even waives this must not be a new convert qualification that he pushes there in Ephesus in 1 Timothy. Virtually everyone on Crete is a new convert. So in considering these points, it really does seem that the second interpretation here is the more likely meaning, that the children who are still living at home or under or who, and who are still living at home are consistently under control, that they can be depended upon to be respectful and well-behaved. And everyone, and they are known by everyone as such. And so the requirement for elders is not that they must necessarily be fathers who have, and so the requirement here for elders is that they must be fathers who have behaving children, not necessarily believing children. But at the same time, if there are children in his home who are not believers, then it is a fair question to ask, why? Especially regarding older kids that we would have expected to have made that commitment. Is there something going on in that home that would cause them to recoil from Christ and his gospel? Something that turns them off? Something that the father is contributing to or responsible for? And I would think that this could be explored and probably should be. All right, so before we move on in this list of qualifications, some concluding comments about what we've covered so far would be in order here. What is being evaluated is the quality of the man's home life. Such a potential elder must demonstrate both strong and yet loving leadership in his family. Just as a teacher is judged by the performance of his students and a coach by the success of his team, so a parent is evaluated by the attitude and behavior of his children. And the objective here is not that he is demanding respect and obedience in the home with a tyrannical iron hand, but is rather inspiring respect and obedience by godly and loving leadership. The children are well behaved. They voluntarily submit to the rules of the home and to him because they truly do respect him. And when you see kids respect their fathers in this way, you can assume that this is because he leads his home out of love for them, and they know that and respond to that favorably. You can have Christian children who are monsters. We all could think of examples of that. And you can have non-Christian children who are respectful and submissive, and we can think of examples of that. What Paul is looking for here are children who are respectful and submissive. For such attitudes and behavior indicates a home that is managed both lovingly and wisely with the correct balance of strength and grace. And, of course, this is exactly what you want in a church leader. If the children have a flagrant disregard for the father's authority, then the question becomes why? What goes on in that home for that to be the case? You know, a man may be able to hide his serious character flaws in public, but he will never be able to hide them in the privacy of his own home. And what happens in the privacy of his home is visible in the public displays of his children. It's just the way it is. And obviously this applies to all fathers, not just church leaders. All right, one more point on this before we move on. The candidate's present conduct, of course, would be more important than his past conduct. I wouldn't be one to think that past failures as a father would disqualify him forever. Paul doesn't elaborate on his statements here. In his typical fashion, he just advances his point and doesn't take time to qualify it. But the language here is present tense. He's not looking to do, so to speak, a criminal background check where you dig things up from long ago. And so we may not want to so we may not want to view this particular qualification about children too rigidly. For instance, to use one possible scenario, what if an unruly man with unruly children later converted to Christ? He was a mean father or a weak father, but then as a Christian became a good father. The younger children in time came in line, but not the older ones, save those perhaps in their late teens. Now, I don't know exactly the answer to that, but I don't think we would want to say without at least thinking through it some, well, absolutely not. The New Testament certainly elevates present conduct over past failures, and I think that that principle should always be kept in mind when working through things like this. All right, let's now move on to verses 7 and 8. How many are still with me so far? All right, more than I expected. Great. Verse 7, since an overseer is entrusted with God's work, he must be blameless, not overbearing, not quick-tempered, not given to drunkenness, not violent, not pursuing dishonest gain. Rather, he must be hospitable, one who loves what is good, who is self-controlled, upright, holy, and disciplined. All right, let's start with that expression, entrusted with God's work. Some translations render it manager of God's household, others God's administrator, others yet as God's steward. I found one that says God's servant manager. They all more or less convey the same thought. Elders are expected to fulfill their duties faithfully and to the fullest, for they are answerable to their master. It is not their church, but God's church. They are under assignment, and it is not an appointment that they get to set the terms of. In the original language, there is actually this transition from elders managing their own household to that of managing God's household. oversight of God's household, that is, his church, has been delegated to certain stewards or administrators who are to fulfill their responsibilities with faithfulness to the task at hand and commitment to the wishes of the master. And in order to fulfill that task and carry out those wishes, such managers will need to possess certain virtues, certain character traits of which are now listed, all of which in one way or another highlight a man's blamelessness. This blamelessness, as we see, is defined negatively with five vices listed in verse 7 and then seven virtues listed in verses 8 and 9. So let's look at these, and because they are pretty straightforward, I won't need to spend a lot of time on each one. The first five relate to common areas of temptation that all people struggle with: pride, temper, alcoholic beverages, power, and money. John Stott refers to these as occupational hazards of Christian leadership. Each are a minefield, a disaster if yielded to. And so we find a parallel argument being implied here. If he can't manage his home, he shouldn't be managing the church. And in the same way, if he can't manage his own conduct and character, he shouldn't be managing the church. The first one is he must not be overbearing. The words carry with it the meanings of being self-willed, stubborn, and arrogant. At the root of this is a fundamental selfishness that drives one to run roughshod over others in an effort to satisfy himself or to get his own way. Leadership roles of any kind, even in a church, can bring a certain level of prestige and power, and church leaders can be tempted to misuse these in order to, you know, advance their own way and pander to their own vanity. And as a result, they can become hardened to constructive advice or criticism, and even lord themselves over other people, even becoming headstrong and domineering. Having a strong personality isn't the issue here. Instead, what is forbidden is someone who is so full of themselves that the church becomes not something they serve as God's steward, but something they coerce into serving them, and they then become the church's master. That's the problem. The next one, not quick-tempered or hot-headed. The fact is, and it's a sad fact, but every church has its share of difficult and demanding people. Pastors and elders are often required to deal with those who are grumblers, hard to please, or want to force their own agendas, or in one way or another, quarrelsome or contentious. The temptation, of course, in those settings is to become impatient, short, irritable, antagonistic, even combative. And this, of course, can become a liability in relationships. What Paul forbids here in particular is this explosive lack of control when impatience and irritability gets the better of him. Not given to drunkenness, in that culture, as is the case today, social functions involved alcoholic beverages. The church leader is not required to abstain, but he is required, again, to exercise self-control, to show responsible moderation in his consumption of wine, for instance. There are obvious reasons why drunkenness is forbidden. One in particular is because excessive drinking often leads to violence, which is the next one on the list. The two kind of go hand in hand. Both are signs that a person lacks the discipline and composure necessary to lead others. So next, not violent. Violence, of course, is an abuse of one's power, one's physical strength. Again, an indication of a person's lack of self-control. This particular qualification seemed a little odd to me at first. Not that I disagreed with it, but the fact that it would be listed, one has to wonder what kind of civilization the church in the ancient world existed in. Were acts of violence against other people so common that Paul felt it necessary to make sure such folks were weeded out? Well, perhaps. In fact, if you go to YouTube and search church fights, you will quickly see that this sort of thing can and does appear in churches today, even among church leaders, as you will see in this video clip.
You're from a minister in his congregation on the steps of a church.
Ready? Start at the beginning. Maybe we can do the... Jim, if you could hit the front light, that might be helpful.
You're from a minister in his congregation.
Caleb.
Savior from a minister in his congregation.
Can I have the light back on? Sorry about that. I thought I'd provide a little comic relief in the middle of a technical sermon here, but what we have here is a pastor who is not getting along with his members, and the members changed the locks on the door, and he's quite upset, so he fires all the trustees, all the elders, and he makes himself supreme. And one of the women of the church slaps him, and he takes his fists and he belts her pretty good right in the face, and is unapologetic about it. So I thought that might be a good, you know, sort of thing to watch. Yeah. So you know, the fact is, you can't an elder of the church or a pastor or any church leader shouldn't go around hitting their church members, all right? And especially ladies, even if they do hit you first. All right, and then I had another video where there was a church where a guy came up through the crowd and hit the minister, and he did not respond, and it was to show the contrast. But I probably don't need to show videos to make the point. I think you guys got it. All right, let's move on to the next one. Not pursuing dishonest gain. This will be funny if you go to now to play the songs at the end of this, and we get the videos that come up instead. All right, not pursuing dishonest gain. The reasons for this are quite obvious. Elders are involved in financial decisions of the church and must therefore be able to withstand any temptation that could, even in the smallest way, be self-serving. Just a couple weeks ago, I read about a church in Kentucky whose pastor was arrested for embezzling over a period of several years $300,000 from the church funds. It's amazing to me. The first thing that came to my mind was, how could he ever do that and not get caught? How could a church with that much money not have better controls in place? But this sort of thing does unfortunately happen. Scholars point out that this particular word here deals more with greed, a preoccupation to gain wealth, than with dishonesty itself, though that is a contributing factor. And so the concern here is that of priorities. You know, what drives a man, serving others or serving himself? If he is obsessed with increasing his wealth, then his priority is obvious. You know, it's not that of serving others. And the danger then is that members in the church, those who have been entrusted to his care and oversight, could end up nothing more than opportunities to that end. A perfect example would be Amway or similar programs. You know, how many pastors or church leaders have exploited their members through programs like this or other commercial endeavors? As we now move on to verse 8, the list turns to positive traits, identifying six widely valued virtues, and then develops a seventh one into a specific ministry requirement, which Paul does in verse 9, which we'll look at the next time. So first on this list would be must be hospitable. I spent two or three sermons on hospitality a few months ago. Essentially, when it comes to church leaders, we are looking for men who are generous, charitable, not stingy or selfish. A willingness to open up their home is certainly an indication of that. Now, in the first century church, hospitality meant something a little bit different than it does today. Travelers often relied upon the generosity of homeowners to put them up for the night, and this would have been a need for missionaries and traveling teachers and other servants of the church, including men like Titus and Paul, for instance. If a man were unwilling to open his home, then this brought into question whether he had fully embraced Christ's charge to share with others in need. Today, we put guests up in motels, and quite frankly, you know, they would rather stay in motels. It seems that the issue here is, as we look at this, is not only generosity, but also the willingness to warmly welcome and receive others into his personal space, into his life. That is, he is a people person. He welcomes the opportunity to get to know others and isn't put off by the inconvenience of serving them. All right, next, one who loves what is good. This is a general statement that is easy enough to see the meaning of. It describes a leader who is generally inclined to pursue those things that are virtuous. One might think of that passage in Philippians 4, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Or in this case, he should love such things, he should pursue those. Who is self-controlled? Self-control is, of course, a major theme in this whole letter used to describe true Christian behavior, one's ability to restrain himself. As noted earlier, self-control is expected of of the five vices in the previous verse, self-control over pride, temper, alcohol, power, and money. Who is upright? The word focuses on behavior that is just, fair, and inherently honest in dealing with others, including business dealings, certainly all dealings. And this would be another word for this would be honorable. All right. I got a short story. You want a story? You want me to pass the story? You want the story? All right. It's been a long time since I've given a story. The story doesn't really illustrate the point at hand, but I want to tell the story anyway. So I'm just going to force it in here. I'll admit it. A number of years ago, I stopped for gas. I pay at the pump, but I have a hankering for a snack, which is not unusual for me. And so I run inside the Quick Mart to buy one. There's about four people ahead of me, and the cashier is a bit grouchy with each customer and is less than pleasant when it's my turn with a short, huffy, "What do you want?" And I hand him a Baby Ruth candy bar. I remember it to this day. It costs $1.19. I gave him the Baby Ruth and a $5 bill. And he gives some change and quickly tosses out five ones and barks out, "Next." Okay, see what's going on? Gave me five ones. So for 3 seconds there or less, I have this full-blown civil war raging inside my conscience. It wasn't that I was greedy for that extra dollar. I just didn't want to reward him for his rude demeanor. But the good angel sitting on the right, is this the right, on my right shoulder, won and said, it won. And so I said, "It looks like you gave me a dollar too much." No, he gave me five ones. Well, whatever it was. Just don't. He gave me four ones. He gave me a dollar too much. I guess he gave me back four ones. So anyway, he threw up my rhythm. But I'm not going to become quick-tempered at this moment. So I was hoping that by doing that, there would be this sweeping change of charitableness that would wash over him. "Well, thank you. You have a nice day." Or something like, "I've worked here 15 years and no one has ever done anything like that. Are you a Christian? Tell me all about that, But that wasn't the case. He grabbed the dollar and acted perturbed that he had to reopen the cash drawer and put it back in. And then he barked again, even more annoying, "Next!" So this was not a satisfying exchange. Nothing about it was satisfying. And so the lesson of the story, John Shutt, you're always good about the moral of the story. The moral of the story here is... Well, that wasn't one I was looking for, but... I had something more along the line of just because you do the honorable thing doesn't mean that it won't turn out crappy, but but at least in the present age, all right. So hopefully in the new creation, the Lord will come up to me one day and say, "Hey, that episode in the gas station, here's a Baby Ruth, And there will be chocolate in heaven. At least milk chocolate. All right, let's move on. No dark chocolate in heaven. It'll be milk chocolate. It'll be the cheap waxy kind and the cheap candy stuff. All right, who is holy? All right, this, of course, is a common word all through the Bible. It describes a condition of the whole person, inward purity that has outward results. All areas of his life, all areas that reflect a desire to please God. He's not compartmentalized. And finally for today, who is disciplined? The term overlaps in its meaning with the term self-control. They're very similar. Typically, self-control has more to do with one's thought life and subsequent behavior. Discipline focuses more on the control of one's body and its appetites. So I have just one more quick story here. Many, many years ago, this one's not a funny one. Many years ago, I heard about a church that was looking for a pastor to hire. And so they worked through the various applications, resumes, found one guy that looked quite promising. They invited him in to give the sermon, and they held a carry-in dinner afterwards, which, of course, would have been a good opportunity for him to interact with other church members. Now, he was a rather large man. He was quite overweight. They didn't hold that against him because there are, many different factors that can contribute to obesity. He gave the sermon, as the story was told to me, it was a home run kind of sermon. Everybody just loved it. But at the carry-in dinner, the cause of his obesity became obvious. multiple trips through the food line, piling his plate up to the max each time, and many trips through the desserts. The church did not extend to him an offer. They wanted to, they really wanted to, but they just couldn't do it. They reasoned that in this he failed to meet the qualifications. He lacked discipline, self-control, and if he wasn't able to manage or restrain this area of his life, what's to say he could manage or restrain other areas of his life, and including what does it say about his managing of a church itself? All right, so this completes our list for today. Again, let me just sort of remind you, as we consider everything listed here in verses 6, 7, and 8, we should note that while they are intended here by Paul to be a means of which to evaluate candidates for eldership, everything on this list are virtues, as we see in the rest of the New Testament, expected of all believers, not just church leaders. But in regards to church leaders, Paul means, and Titus understands, that such men under consideration must have a sound reputation. There can be no grounds of accusation against them in their marriage, in their home life, in their conduct, and in their character. And this, again, is essentially the meaning of being blameless. They have gained a certain respectability with people at large and are therefore able and qualified to serve as God's manager over his household, the church. There is one other area that the elder must be blameless in. We'll take that up the next time. We find it in verse 9. He is to be above reproach in matters of doctrinal orthodoxy. All right, so this time we'll let the children come in. Let's stand and we'll have the musicians come and continue the service with songs of praise.